This is an appeal from Bad Boy Running.
In a world shattered by COVID and lockdown, hundreds of do-badders are taken to the streets and trails with the aim of staying fit.
They are breaking more PBs, reducing their times, and building endurance and athleticism.
Alcohol tolerance is dropping to critical levels, and our chubby funster status is under severe threat. This has to stop. It's time to get lazy and mediocre again.
That's why Bad Boy Running has partnered with takeaway delivery service Food Hub, so we can get vital takeaways to do-badders in their time of need.
By downloading the Food Hub app, you get exclusive offers and discounts from your favourite local independent restaurants and takeaways, so you can stuff your little face with thousands of calories, all without leaving your sofa.
Food Hub aren't like other food apps who charge commission to the restaurants. This means ordering through Food Hub is on average 15% cheaper for the same meal and 30% less racist.
Food Hub also won't charge you that surface charge the others do. Cheeky bastards.
So download Food Hub today and use FYB15. 15% off your first Food Hub order.
Together, let's get Britain back to the top of the obesity tables.
They're bad, they're boys, and occasionally they talk about running. Yes, it's the Bad Boy Running Podcast with your hosts, Jody Rainsford and David Heller.
Come back, baby, come back.
Bye, 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 bye. Bye, 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 bye. I must admit I was a clown to be messing around. But that doesn't mean that you have to leave town.
Hello, Jody Rainsford.
Hello, David Hellard. How are you?
I'm good, I'm good. But before that, remember we're introducing who our guest is today. Oh, a little snippet, a little teaser. Oh, my word. This interview is... Well, we've been waiting 6 months, maybe longer, trying to get Connie on the podcast, and she has thankfully agreed. Really, really interesting. It's all to do with Connie Allen, who was involved. She was born into the Hasidic Jewish community and then eventually left and found escape through running. So we talked to her. It's quite a long interview because a lot of it is just to do with culture of the community and understanding of, you know, where it's, how it came about and what the rules were, but really, really interesting about defining of people's truth, really, and scratching that itch of wanting to break out and finally doing it. So that is all to come, my friends, all to come. But before then, Happy New Year, baby, nearly.
I don't think it will be New Year when this comes out, but yeah, Happy New Year, definitely Happy Christmas.
And it is going to be, well, I'm not even sure if we can have a New Year or a Christmas at this stage. Mama B may have COVID, so Briggsy and I are likely to be in, just in our own flat by ourselves. But worse than that, we're going to have to cook for ourselves. And no one wants to eat that. No one. So...
Bye from Food Hub.
Bye from Food Hub. Do Pot Noodle do a Christmas edition?
I don't know, but at least you know what, for Christmas you've got sweet, sweet isolation with your partner. For Christmas I've got gout in my other foot.
No. It's spread.
Can you believe it?
Have you been chewing on your left-hand side of your mouth rather than your right?
I can't believe it. I can't believe I've got gout again. I mean, that's pretty bad. Twice in 6 months.
And why did it come back?
No idea. Well, no one knows how it came in the first place. So if no one knows how it came in the first place, it's weird. I don't know. No one knows.
Do you out of run? You're off running again.
Yeah. Off running again. It's crazy. It's really crazy. Slightly different situation is that one of the issues that we thought might have been with the first one, which the doctor suggested, was because I was running and there was a concern that actually maybe dehydration might have played a part in it as well. But this time, I certainly wasn't running even close to the same amount. And the only running I was doing was on a treadmill. So it wasn't a huge amount of friction, you know, in terms of like before I was, you know, running trail and stuff. And so your foot's moving about a lot more. There's a lot more friction against the side of it. Your feet getting wet, all kinds of stuff. This one, my feet have been, you know, in a nice cushioned shoe on a treadmill.
Well, moving. You're getting dehydrated because your feet were sweating so much from the friction.
I don't have particularly sweaty feet, actually. I'm okay in that respect. But I do get really dehydrated. But I was drinking loads. I've been drinking, like, that's the thing, you know, since the last thing, I drink, you know, so much more water. I've got one of those giant bottles that you just fill the water for the whole day and you've got to finish it by the end of the day.
I mean, how dark are we talking? We're talking about one of the bottles that you turn upside down as an office cooler.
Just to stand underneath it.
I would love to see that.
This is actually good. It's a gallon. It's like 3,500 mils, whatever. So it's a big chunk. But what it does...
You drink that every day?
Yeah. And so it
has 7 pints.
Yeah. So it has. I know. Well, because I was thinking, like, this is the thing that might have caused the previous one. But it has little marks on it to say, you know, how much you have to drink by certain times, because you don't want to get to like 11 o'clock in the evening and you've still got like 2 pints to drink or whatever, because, you know, you're not going to sleep. So it has this thing by going, good morning, you're doing great. Like 11 o'clock, nearly halfway, like 1 o'clock. Go smash it, champ.
Did you carry that round to meetings? Are you like Jada Senna, where you've got this huge weight at all times?
If it was Joe DeSena, it's someone else would be carrying it as part of a challenge that they'd be doing. No, what do you mean, what meetings? Like, working from home. I've barely been out, and I certainly can't go out now. I'm stuck in bed.
You're stuck in bed because of the cow?
Yeah, I don't think people quite realise how painful it is. I can't move around. It is so painful. It doesn't look the same as the last one, though. The last one, there was a lot more redness around my foot. This one is... it seems to be a little bit more localized, but oh, it's so incredibly painful. We've had so many deliveries that I mean I can't get to the door, so I've just left them on the front step waiting for Libby to come home so she can bring them all in.
Have your kids, when they, I mean, they're not allowed to do this, but when they next go to see Santa and they sit on his knee and Santa's like, so little one, what would you like for Christmas? Oh, I'd just like Daddy not to have gout.
Weirdly, my kids don't like that. Like, they've never liked going to see Father Christmas, which is weird. The last time we went to see Father Christmas, we went... This sounds a bit twatty, okay? We went to Harrods when Frieda was younger, which you can't do anymore, because I think there's a rule now that if you go to Harrods, you've got to spend at least $2,000 if you want to see Father Christmas. There's some ridiculous, like, elitist...
We get you one marble.
But it was brilliant. So the one we and that was the last time we went. And she's never wanted to see him since. We went there, and obviously, you know, for some reason they put the Santa's Grotto in Harrods on like the most difficult place to get to if you had a pushchair. She was that young, and so it was like up a load of steps on the third floor with an escalator and stuff like that. But it was great. We went there, right next to the dog grooming area. We went there, and
so both areas were for grooming.
Yeah, well, you say that, but no, we went in, and the guy who was the Father Christmas was clearly some just wonderful West End queen who just took his role so seriously. It was like, it was, you know, like Simon Callow in Four Weddings and a Funeral. He was like that. He obviously, this man had obviously
happened
before, and now this was his swan song as Father Christmas. it was brilliant. That was the last Father Christmas that we saw, and it was the best Father Christmas. But since then, they're just not interested at all seeing Father Christmas or anything else like that, which is weird, because when we were younger, we literally saw Father Christmas at any opportunity we could do. But no, they don't give a shit about me, the pain in my foot. You know, as long as the PlayStation's working.
Oh, well, I mean, they've got their priorities right, to be fair.
exactly. But yeah, how are things with... I'm not going to ask you about your injury, because there's little point in everything. But, you know, how are you feeling in yourself over this Christmas period?
There is one positive side effect of my injury. So
Wait, did I see a picture of you out running, or was that a picture from a previous year? Was it you dressed as a turkey or something like that?
Oh, I attempted to run before I see my physio, Claire.
Of course.
Well, whenever you see your physio, there's nothing worse than you haven't seen them for 2 months, and they go, "Oh, does it hurt still?" And you go, "No, not really." I'm like, "Oh, you're fixed, right?" "Well, no, because I've not done anything." So you always go out for a run just to test how it's going.
Yeah.
So I ran about a mile and then jumped on a bike because it was, God damn it. One of the things that the previous physio had said was, "I need to work on my pelvic floor." I think we've discussed this.
Talked about you and your pelvic floor. I just thought your pelvic floor would, you'd have a pelvic floor like Arnie by now.
Well, I do. Well, not only now, he's probably got a terrible pelvic floor given his age.
I bet he doesn't. I bet his pelvic floor is strong as anything.
But yeah, probably is actually. But I've realised the last few months, well, even the last year, I've started to need the toilet at night, which has really annoyed me. And also, I've started to wake myself up with farts in the morning, which.
What?
Yeah, and I guess there's just been a general loosening of that whole region. And so I've realised with the pelvic floor exercises, that doesn't have to be the case. And so now, whenever I get on the tube coming to work, every tube stop, I go through the motions of doing a pelvic floor and is it the anal floor? I don't know what the muscle would be. Oh, the sphincter muscle. And I do my exercises. So if you ever see me on the tube, and I have a very strange look on my face, it's because I'm going through my exercises and it works. I now don't need to wake up in the middle of the night to go to the toilet, and I'm not fighting myself awake anymore. So there is a positivity to this injury. But happy Christmas, people. That's my gift to you. You can fight the farts. Yes.
Stepping on the tube and looking down the length of the carriage, and you stood there looking into the mid distance, your pelvis slightly rocking forward and backwards.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing. So,
if you ever come across David and he looks like he's sort of pausing for thought or he's not engaged in anything, do not interrupt him. He may be tightening his sphincter.
Wow, he's a deep thinker, isn't he? He's got the weight of the world on his shoulders. But we normally talk a little bit about stuff before we get on with we haven't got a huge amount to discuss today, because actually running stopped, life stopped, the world stopped, but
yeah,
I have been watching the Spartan Games still.
Oh, you're still watching them? Okay, how has that happened? How's that been?
Have you watched any of it?
No. Why would I watch it? Why do I watch it when you can watch it for me?
We have a love-hate relationship with Spartan, mainly because we are puny runners and we feel inferior to all Spartan people, but also they do court controversy in ways we don't necessarily always agree with. But
Next guest, Joe DeSena.
We are actually lining up currently. So, Joe, if you listen to this one, win us back with your interviewing technique. But this has been brilliant. The Spartan Games. Watch it, because I know everyone right now is short of good things to watch. And last time we'd had, I think I watched two episodes. And if you didn't listen to those episodes of our podcast, they've taken endurance athletes from across the US and brought them together.
Spartan-like sports, and put them in a Spartan Games plus an ultra runner.
Yeah, to basically reinforce that Spartan athletes are the best at events chosen by the Spartan team. But they've got a really good mix of people. They've got an elite marathon runner, female runner, they've got a male ultra runner, they've got a Jared Shoemaker, who's a high-end triathlete, they've got a ninja warrior guy, maybe that's Jared. So they really have got a good mix, and they have the competitions are all interesting because they are a mix of fitness, endurance, and strength. Now, when I last left off, we had our friend Mike Wardian, who was representing us as runners. It turns out they hadn't really featured one of the top 10 female marathon runners in American history. She's also on there. And so this episode, it comes to our chance to shine. There's a trail race.
Oh, okay.
Six-hour trail race. Very off-road, very steep. And, you know, last time I'd been speaking to Mike about it, and or messaging him on Instagram, and he'd been suggesting that he hadn't felt great about his performance. My fear was that as ultra runners, we know we're not meant for anything else in life. But also, when I first took up...
But do you mean in the sporting arena or just anything?
I think anything other than long stories. We're not suited towards. But my fear was, when I'd gone into obstacle racing the first time, it wasn't until then I realised how much, if you don't train for multi-sports, that anything weights just destroys your legs. And actually, it could take a while to come back from. Yeah. So Mike goes into, this is our point where I'm like, come on, Mike. And I can't remember. Maybe, yeah, because Kellen Taylor, new name to me, but maybe a name that our American friends know. Kellen Taylor, does that make sense? So they go out. Mike looks great. And the first few hundred meters, all of the, I guess the alpha males are there kind of joshing away. Mike's pretty chilled, maybe in fifth place. Get to the hill, out come the poles. Boom! Mike's smashing around. But then after about two laps, you don't really see what's going on, and Mike just looks absolutely done in. And this is, you know, I'm sure he'd absolutely destroy everyone on this terrain and this race normally, but you can see that he's had seven events in a row before this that have the equivalent of having dead legs punched on you. And bless her. Kellen Taylor, she goes out, she is so super fast, absolutely nailing it, but she is a road runner, and this is more like European trail rather than American trail, which tends to be lovely, almost the roads but on a different surface.
Yeah, no, exactly what you mean. Yeah,
whereas this was very much down the side of a mountain, typical Spartan technical. Yeah, and so poor Kellen, she is essentially starting to get injured from this. And she makes a call, having absolutely destroyed the field for two, three laps. Like, well, I can't risk my future career because I still need to race in the next half a year. She pulls out. Mike, bless him, having looked so incredible, he just looked like a withered shell of himself, and it's heartbreaking to see these Spartan athletes go on and win it, because ultimately they've trained their legs to have the crap beaten out of them repeatedly and to still be able to do endurance. And it's amazing, you know, it's impressive, it's incredibly impressive. It's something I in my heart thought could happen, but it just reinforces us as runners. We really need to be doing a lot of weight training, and we need to protect our body against the kind of damage that we do when we race hard. And yeah, well, I mean, would you expect that yourself?
No, I think there's a lot to be said about incorporating that, and how, I mean, it's quite well talked about now, isn't it, in terms of, you know, athletes who are having to race on a regular basis, incorporating a lot more strength work in it to become a bit more resilient in that respect. I'm just trying to think, have we had any episodes where we've talked about strength training? I don't think we have. I don't think we've talked about, we've had someone on specifically talking about strength training for runners and ultra runners or any type of runner, which I think that might be quite a good one, wouldn't it?
probably the closest thing we had was Camille Herron's first interview, where she was talking about how she was incorporating it and the upper body stuff. But what was lovely about the show as well, and you're always worried about how you're going to be represented as a sport, and actually...
That's probably when you're on a show, you're always going to be worried about how you're represented, David. I don't particularly worried about that.
That's true. That's true. You know, that's why I've been trying to clean up the whole fart myself awake thing, just in case I'm ever on television again. But what was great about it is they've got all these different events. And firstly, there are a lot of people there who had never run that far before.
Oh, right. Okay.
But also, it really, it brought light to how ultra running is different from everything else in how emotional people were getting through their achievement and how they're used to pushing hard. They're used to breaking themselves, going through pain barriers. But this experience for all of those athletes was completely unique in everything they'd done, because it's just the length of time that you're doing something and the self-doubt. And that's what was actually beautiful about this show. You had people really having to spend a lot of time with their emotions and to take themselves into places they'd never been. And I thought, actually, as an advert for our sport, it was one of the best adverts
terrible,
you could have.
Terrible.
Well, yeah.
Wow, that's exactly what you want. You go, oh, you do this sport and it'll take you within yourself. It will fill you, it'll rack you with self-doubt. You'll go on a roller coaster of emotions that will leave you crying at the end of it. Enjoy!
And really bad at all other sports.
Yeah, that's it. It's an interesting thing. It's an interesting thing you say with that, because I think, you know, this is a realization that I got when I did Winter Nuts. That's the first time I've done an OCR type thing before. And the first time, you know, and that was 6 hours, 6 hours. And, you know, there was always talk about, oh, you know, you can do this thing for 6 hours. You know, can you do it for 6 hours? You know, it's a lot of time to do it. It was supposed to be 8 hours, of course, but, you know, some twat cut me off before, you know, the time. But the interesting thing about that is that 6 hours went really, really quickly. They didn't feel like 6 hours at all. Whereas 6 hours of running does not go quickly. Like 10 minutes of running doesn't go quickly. 6 hours of running, you know, you have forgotten about the running, you know, after a couple of hours. It's just you and your thoughts over that period of time. Whereas, you know, 6 hours of going on an obstacle course, because you're so into it, you're constantly engaged. There is no time for, you know, thinking, you know, it's sort of inward reflection, because you're constantly doing stuff, upper body, lower body, you know, trying to get over the next obstacle and stuff like that. So you don't have that. So I can imagine, you know, I mean, kind of, you know, OCR is kind of like ADHD, you know, like attention deficit. Yeah. I need to be doing something every few minutes. You know, it serves a purpose. It attracts people, you know, because of that and the way you fit. It's a little bit like, I suppose it's kind of like orienteering or something like that, in the sense that there's always something to be doing. There's always something about thinking next. And so that appeals to a certain type. Whereas I think when, you know, moving someone from that to running, that is a big, big jump, especially, you know, is it a 6 hour race?
You had 6 hours to complete as many laps as you could. And so...
And it's the monotony of that as well. Monotony you don't mind, I think, on an OCR course, because you're doing it. But it's just knowing you've got to run back through something again, and the amount of time it takes, it's the mental aspect of all of it that I think is that...
Yeah.
It's totally different.
And what was lovely about it, because, you know, you had... I can't read up my notes. I'm not sure if Jared Shoemaker is the triathlete who came seventh. I put that in there just so we can say, you see, Mike, it's the beating up beforehand. It's not the fact he had a bad day. Like, Jared's a top-class triathlete and came seventh. But it's either him or Jared might be the Ninja Warrior. I can't read my notes. Apologies, listeners. But, what was great, you had people like that, and you also had a former NFL, I think he's a linebacker. And at the end of it, they were all so happy with their performance and like having done it. Whereas with other sports, if you hadn't done well, you felt frustrated because you could see how much worse you were than someone else. Yeah. Whereas that's what was lovely about it. You had a visible example of how ultra running is different in that the achievement is finishing and doing as much as you can. It's not necessarily on the placings.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I completely agree with that. That's really interesting that, you know, it's good, you know, it's good to open up and you kind of want it to be like that as well. You don't want it to kind of be shown as like, oh, that was just a long run.
Yeah.
Because it's more.
Yeah, 100%. And, but did you see the talking about end of the year? Have you seen the Strava PDF they've been sending around and their stats?
Oh, I think I saw some different stats reported in different places. I think there was one stat I saw about women's involvement in sport has massively risen in terms of is it running, swimming, and cycling? Hopefully not together, but though, you know, huge increases in the number of people who are doing sport on a regular basis.
Super cool, and it's. You can see the effect of the pandemic, but also the
fact that it's nothing to do with England athletics. Nothing. It's like they'll credit with themselves, but it'll be nothing to do with them at all.
But it's also amazing where they've broken it down country by country, and you can see how the decisions of the local governments and when Corona hit has dramatically changed who's been doing what activities when, indoors, outdoors, more, less. But the really great news is that so many more people were being more active or taking up the sport. And that's not tailed off. You know, even when we hit our summer and things were good, you know, we're back in lockdown now. But we always, you know, it's been a year that's been hard to find positives. But that truly is a positive that people are being more active. It will be interesting to see if that, you know, next year, if that's going to be the same, if people have this.
Well, when we can get back to pubs.
Yeah, exactly. When we can return back to normality, have people discovered a new joy, or is it just filling up the time or there's nothing else to do? Yeah. But yeah, as you said, JD, it's brilliant in that it's really been a huge number of all involvements involved, but actually... Well, women have been taking up exercise at a higher rate than men, far higher. And we've always said that it's a shame that there aren't more women in trail running, in ultra running, in running even, that it's still not 50-50. And this could be the introduction that helps give a kickstart to getting even more women into the sport. So fingers crossed to that. And very clever by Strava for getting this information out there. Because it's very good marketing for them.
This is weird because we're introing this to the Connie, even though we've just recorded the outro for something else when we're talking about the vodka.
So this would be a great segue into Connie. But actually, before we do that, I have said to a friend I'd help him out a bit and hopefully help you out a bit. A friend of mine has recently started a new startup called Kaveri Drinks, and they make a new type of vodka. And he's looking for people. They've done one batch, a small batch, and he's looking for people to try out the vodka and be able to give feedback on what they think of it. And to encourage that, he's given a massive discount. So he's giving 30% off the RRP. And the big sell on the vodka is that, firstly, it's completely vegan. And also, it is just far healthier. They don't distill as many times as other vodkas because the ingredients are better, and also it's got some flavor to it. I tried it last night. It's got ginger, it's got basil, and it also has something else that I can't find in my notes.
Did you not tell? Is your palate not refined enough to be able to tell it while you were tasting?
Well, we had it with rosemary, so ginger. The good question. Good wife of Mr. Claus. Is that the joke? No, Mr. Christmas, Rosemary. Sorry. But if you like vodka, or if you like flavored gin,
or you like ginger,
or if you like ginger,
if you are ginger, you should be supporting this. If you're not buying this, then this is a travesty.
It is a travesty, like your life, G-Law. But if you If you want to try it out, I really liked it, and I don't really like vodka. So it's just Kaveri Drinks, K-A-V-E-R-I drinks.com. The passcode is FYB, and you'll be helping him out. But please, if you do buy some, if you could give some honest feedback, because it's just great to be involved in a brand. But he's looking for feedback on what you think it's like, because they're still in the crafting phase of the booze. So get it, people, get it. But from a lovely drink to someone who said that you shouldn't drink. So sorry about that, Kaveri Drinks. Connie is not with you on this. But we did this interview 2 days ago. It's amazing. Connie's wonderful. Thank you so much. And take it away, Nick.
So, Do-Badders, I've been wanting to get our next guest on for quite a few months, actually. I was reading an article, I think an outdoor magazine or similar to that, a really good article about Connie and how she had been a part of the Hasidic Jewish community in New York and had left that community and really found an escape emotionally through running. And I thought it was such an amazing story and one I wanted to share, but also to understand more. So welcome on the podcast, the lovely Connie Allen. Yay! How are you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for having me. It's so nice to actually meet you in over the computer, not in person, but
one day in person.
We've been talking for months, so I'm pretty excited to do this. So thank you for having me here.
Oh, of course. I mean, should we start from the beginning of understanding the Hasidic Jewish community? Because I feel I personally have a bit of an awareness of the community because there's a large community in Stamford Hill in London who I've often run past. My friend Ali lives right in the midst of them. So we've come back at night and seen like the males doing some kind of celebration thing, lifting people on chairs. But I think for a lot of people, there's just a lot of not a lot of knowledge of who this community are and what the rules are and how they interact with each other and the wider community. So how would you describe the Hasidic Jew community? Is that the best way to term it?
It's Hasidic. Yeah. I wouldn't say Jewish. It's definitely a part of it's a sect of the Jewish community, which we call Hasidic. There's a lot of components within the community. There's a good, there's a bad, there's a gray, there's a white and black. There's a lot of them. And the reason a lot of people don't know about it is because they are so good at keeping it a closed, tight-knit community. They've been successful, to do so for so many years. There's good. There's a lot of good in the community. They're very community-based, and this is something that most people love and flourish off. Somebody's sick, or if somebody's, having a baby, or something's going on, there's somebody's poor, they will all help one another. They'll jump in. There's no people living on the street in the community. Very, very rarely that'll happen. You go in the city, there's so many homeless peoples. But within Brooklyn, the South Williamsburg or Borough Park or, probably London too, you would not find a Hasidic people sleeping on the street, because people will take them in, support them, help them out. They have their own grocery stores. They have their own doctors. They have their own systems. Everything is built to support one another. So, which is why a lot of, most people in the community don't even have to go to college, because they can get a job immediately just with the support of the community. There's definitely the really amazing things of the community that is important to highlight, because they are so great at helping and caring and all that good stuff.
And do you have to be born into the community, or can you say you met someone, would you be able to commit to becoming Hasidic?
So the term would be convert. You'd have to be a convert, and you'd have to go through a lot of steps in order to do so. It happens very rarely, because they put on a lot of rules and regulations to do so. It happened. They definitely, I know some people who converted to Judaism. They married a spouse or whatever. They decide they fell in love with the community. It doesn't happen often. But yeah, you're usually born into it generation after generation. you know, a lot of them coming from Hungary, a lot of them from Israel, Russia, it's a big, you know, place where we came from. My personal story, my parents, my father's side is from Hungary, my mother's side from Israel. So I definitely have a mix of both of the cultures from Israel and Europe.
And do you get a sense of the fact that the community is so self-sufficient? Do you think that's because of wanting to protect the community, or Definitely. Is it also kind of distrusting the outside community? Or
it's both. It's both. They don't want people to leave. They don't want them to feel that they can go someplace else, because if you open those doors, then a lot of them will leave. And it's all about power and control within the, you know, for the rabbis and the communities there. So they don't want you to leave. They absolutely don't. Once there's like, if there's any sign of you trying to leave, they will either push you out or make your life a living hell just by trying. So it's definitely to keep you closed in there. They give you no skills on how to like even deal with the outside world. If you were to leave, you're going to have so many struggles, so many challenges overcome. So it's definitely been a challenge for me to leave, and I'm still learning. I'm still growing every day. I feel that even it's been a decade, they've definitely made it hard for me.
And how would you compare what are the power dynamics within that community? And particularly for a female, you know, we're moving towards a more equal society, you know, not there yet, but certainly legally your rights are protected as a female. Is there a disconnect between is it a patriarchal society?
It definitely is. They are trying to control you, especially females. There's no room for growth, you know, within the sexes. It's all about male power. Again, this is all Hasidic, not Jewish. I have to specify that, because there's some Jewish communities that are very empowering for women and very encouraging, even female rabbis. But the community that we grew up, we were baby makers. That's it. We were raised to raise kids. And that was our one goal and one goal only, to a point where if you couldn't have kids, you were shunned upon, like you were looked down on, and you're like, oh, something's wrong with you. You are just not good enough for God. God punished you. So it's definitely like, you know, women can't drive. We can't ride bikes. We weren't allowed to really do anything. We're not even like the men need to go to synagogue. We don't have to go to synagogue. We could, but we don't have to, because it's not our requirement. So it was really empowering males to grow, you know, towards God, and women supporting them.
And when you were...
How does the wider Jewish community view the Hasidic sect then? Is it seen as something that's... Is it something that I'm trying to understand like the sort of the dynamic between it. Is it seen as something completely separate, or is it just seen as something that's maybe the slightly more orthodox, the more stricter side of it, or is it seen as completely separate?
That's actually a really good question. I think that there's so many cults within the Jewish community. There's the Chabad community, which is very encouraging. And I know they have a lot of them in the UK as well. And they kind of share some beliefs with the Hasidic people because they had the same rabbi back in the days. But definitely Hasidic people are not favored by the rest of the Jewish community for those reasons that they are not, you know, encouraging the women. A lot of their rules are very segregated, just even, you know, in terms of the other Jews. Like when I grew up, my parents didn't even allow me to like talk to other Jewish people outside of our community. That's how bad they felt towards them. So it's more the Hasidic community hating them, the other side, versus them looking down at you. They have their own rules, their own rabbis. very, very, very separate, extremely separate.
And do you get a sense of what caused, like, when that separation existed and what caused it?
So I wish I learned, I wish I listened better to my teachers in school.
Me too.
Classes. But yeah, it was a rabbi, the Baal Shem Tov, they used to call him. And he started the Hasidim. I think that was just after the war or during the World War II. That's when the Hasidic community was established. It was, you know, the rabbis came from Europe. And they had to have a place to live because they didn't want to live in Europe any longer. So that's when the whole Hasidic community started. And it started with one main rabbi, which is a Satmar rabbi. That was after the previous rabbi died. The rabbi came from a small shtetl in Europe called Satmar. And he brought all his people here. And that's when they started. So he was supposedly one of the nicer people. He was not very politically driven. Once he died, which was probably 20 some years ago, I think I remember when he died because I was a young kid. That's when it really started becoming really divided towards different cults within the Hasidic community. And there was a lot of political fights, like physical fights, even though I remember those things. But like I said, it started really after the war when they came from Europe and they had to really find themselves a safe place because they were all, you know, tried to be killed, you know, all those few years. So they tried to have a safe place and they tried to really get closed and not be around other non-Jews because they were worried and scared of another world war, so to speak, and to kind of clear out the Jewish community.
And you can completely understand their desire to, you know, protect themselves and to isolate themselves from, you know, what's gone before. And for you then growing up, when did you ever really interact with people outside of the community? And what did you think of the outsiders?
They really taught us to hate everyone outside of the community. They told us that the people who are walking by the streets, you know, the people working there, like the delivery people or the people and the janitors in our school and all that stuff, that they're thieves, thugs, drug abusers. That's what they taught us. And they and especially people of color, they taught us and they instilled in us that hate towards that. And that was really horrible because until I left, I don't think I understood that. I don't think I knew what it was like to live, you know, to even like interact with a non-Jew. And so that was, you know, in my low 20s when I learned that.
And would you have access to the internet, television, papers, media that was from outside the community?
Absolutely not. No, my dad would be, he had a typewriter in the house back then. So, and at one point he did get this big bulky computer, I remember, but he right away glued, he put crazy glue in the Wi-Fi box, in the, not the Wi-Fi, the internet cable. In there. And I remember, I'm like, okay, interesting. And then at one point we got the CD player that had the radio on it. And the same thing, he put glue on it. So we had no access. The media and the newspapers that we got or bought was within the community. Like I said, everything was designed to kind of just give you the news insight from you know, the community's perspective only. Even politics, you know, with the elections and all that stuff, we were told for who to vote. We couldn't have our own opinion who to vote for. So all that was very, very one-sided.
What was your like trying to step back into those shoes? What was your kind of view of America and the outside world? I mean, that must have, going from that into and then sort of like discovering kind of the reality of it. How,
what kind of what yeah, I just don't really know how to phrase it. it's so cognitive to think you didn't use a radio.
So how do you view your younger self?
Yeah, absolutely. That's it. How so, do you self view it?
When we were raised to feel chosen, that God chose the Jewish people as the saviors, and when Messiah will come, we will own the land of Israel, and we will again be reunited with God. So we were always brought up with this mindset that we are the one, and the rest of the world is not. So we looked down at everyone else. We were like, oh, these are just thugs, like I said before. They're just there to help us get where we need to get to. And when Messiah will come and rescue us from this earth, we will be chosen and they will be gone. So when you have such a mindset, when all you think about is, oh, wow, I'm special. They're nothing. They're nobodies. So, you know, we lived in Brooklyn, and we would very rarely leave our little community. But I remember that one time my oldest sister had a baby, and I was probably a teenager at the time, low teen, probably maybe. I wasn't even a teen yet. But anyways, we took the train into the city to visit her to Maimonides Hospital in Manhattan. And that was my first time leaving Brooklyn. And I remember we couldn't look at anyone, because if we look at the non-Jewish people, we would, like, our eyes would get impure. That's how they made us feel. Like, every time we would leave the community, it's like, you shouldn't do it. It's a really bad thing. It's worst case, you know, like, last scenario, that you should never leave your little community, because you have to shelter your eyes. The things that go into your brain will corrupt you and all that stuff. So, like, that one time we went to the city, or we had cousins in upstate. There's a little town called Monroe, where it's very segregated, like, closed community, gated, you know, extremely segregated from the rest of the town. So we had a lot of cousins there, and we would have weddings all the time. So we would have to pass through the city to go up north. And again, if, you know, we had our own buses, our own, you know, all that transportation. But I would always look outside of the window and see these billboards, and we pass the city, and I'm like, is that, like, I would be drooling, and I obviously had to make sure my mom was asleep and she couldn't see that out the window. And then I see these, like, Calvin Klein underwear models.
Oh, wow.
My mouth just dropped. I'm like,
they made my mouth drop, and I'm not even that way inclined. So,
but yeah, we were very limited with our exposure. And I'd have to say, until I left, I really was not exposed to anything.
Because how big is that community? How many people in the Brooklyn area?
So it's pretty wild. They have a one-mile radius, 1 mile square foot area where they live in, and there's about 75,000 people living there.
Wow. That's a sized city.
Yeah. They live in closed, really small apartments. They have a lot of kids. The average amount of kids is like 8 to 10. So you have two parents, 8 to 10 kids, and probably, you know, 500 square foot apartment.
Wow.
It's crazy the way they live there, yeah.
And how do a lot of New Yorkers just naturally pass through that area? And how also, given that the families are so big, is that community expanding?
So they are expanding. You know, I said that they have a little town in Monroe. It's in Orange County upstate New York.
So are younger people basically being forced out because of prices, or is that 1 mile becoming 1.1 mile? And
not really, because, I mean, it did expand. When I grew up on that one corner on Lee Avenue on Hayward, we were, like, considered at the edge of Williamsburg, at the edge of our community. But now they probably have expanded already a quarter mile past that. But they're building higher buildings. There's a lot of tall buildings there. So it fits more people in. So they've expanded. Like, my sister now, who I don't talk to, she moved to Monticello, New York. So they have, they're like expanding to other neighborhoods, a little bit cheaper, a little bit further out. So they, you know, open their own communities, their own schools, synagogues, and all that stuff.
And they have. Is the money to build and buy, is, does that come in from, I guess, males' jobs in the outside world, or like how does it financially come into contact with Western society?
Yeah, so definitely the Jewish people are known for their real estate experience, or, you know, working in with the diamond industry and all that. I never had any exposure to that. My dad never had a job. He was always the one studying the Bible. He was always just sitting in front of his book. So I never really had any exposure to any of that. But I know there's a lot of people in the community that do that. They have real estate. They do have more access to the outside world, and they expand. And so Williamsburg, there's North Williamsburg, South Williamsburg, and all that. So North Williamsburg is, I'm not sure if you know about that area. It's prime real estate right now. I mean, it's kind of like the city, in this New York City, where you get all the hipsters and all the artists and all the young kids who their parents have huge trust funds for them. So the apartments there are really expensive, and guess who owns them?
Oh, so a lot of them are rented out, and gotcha. Okay.
The Hasidic people have bought these buildings and apartments and all these stuff many years ago when real estate was super cheap. And they're really profiting off that.
And it's interesting what you were saying earlier about not wanting to almost look upon the outside world, because that's the one thing, maybe wrongly, whenever I've run through Stamford Hill, the kids, they just stare at me as if I'm, you know, a fish riding a bike.
Yeah, and I always
and I always make a point of just beaming massive smiles at all of them, or else just singing loud that whatever song I've got on my headphones, which I don't know whether that's, you know, a good thing or a bad thing. In my head, I just want them to feel as if, you know, they're welcome. But
I can give you a couple of tips. You tell them certain Yiddish words, and they will literally, their eyes will fall out. That'd be better. Your English song. If you tell them a couple of Yiddish words or Hebrew words, they will think you fell from the moon.
And is sport part of that community?
Absolutely not. Not even for the boys. We were never allowed to even, like I said, ride a bike, ride a scooter. Nothing. Some boys were. My brothers weren't. Some boys were allowed. My parents just was absolutely no. Like, the only thing that the girls were allowed to play was rubber. I'm not sure if you know what that is. You take a big rubber and you like wrap it around your feet and you jump over, like you hop and you have certain.
Like, is that hopscotch?
It's not hopscotch. It's kind of like that, but it's like two people are standing. One person, maybe like a couple feet away, and the other person.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Around your feet and like called? Get it wider and wider, and you're supposed to jump to touch the rubber.
So, like, jump
rope, we'd play. But really, we have not had any exposure to any kind of sport, even walking. Like, we never walked. We never moved our bodies in a way that made us feel healthy and good. All we did was, you know, count down to the Shabbat, which is, you know, it's Friday night, and we had our meals and holiday meals. It's all about food and prayers and food and prayers again. That's really what the only things that we had.
Is it because sport is just not part of that culture, and so it, or is it very specifically looked down upon as something that shouldn't be encouraged or done?
They don't see a point of having it. So the men are, you know, praying to God and, you know, obeying God's laws, and God has a set rule, you know, all these rules that they have to obey, and they have to do that. And the women are just there to make babies. So there was really nothing, there was no point.
Right.
There was no point of having fun. Like, if my mother caught us laughing too hard, she's like, why are you laughing? You shouldn't do that. So everything was just towards God. You have to please God. You have to focus on God. You can't be too happy. You can't have all the pleasures in life, because then you're not taking it serious. You know, it's like the ultimate goal of Messiah coming and rescuing us from this bad earth that we're stuck in.
Were you, because I was before you'd said that statement, I was going to ask, like, where did you find your happiness? But were you trying to even find happiness? Or were you trying to find your role in this community? Or were you almost accepting of you just move one step forward towards God?
That's a deep question. And I was a very depressed child. We had a depressed home environment. My mother would always cry. We catch her, you know, reading the, you know, Jewish books and crying. And we were expected to respect that. And there was really nothing to look forward to besides like holidays and weekends. But then holidays and weekends just meant more studying and more, you know, reading the Bible. There was nothing to look forward to. There was absolutely, at least in my family, it was just a very sad vibe. I know this is not everyone in the community was like that. A lot of the other families had more of a family vibe and the connection and the love, and everyone was allowed to share and talk. We weren't allowed to. My mother would always just kind of stop us every time we'd start talking about our feelings or anything that is too earthly. She would really stop us and say, hey, we're not supposed to talk about this.
And did you get any, were there any times where you managed to smuggle in something illicit, or suddenly learn the words to a Madonna song, or get a Twix bar suddenly dropped on the street nearby? Did that ever happen, that kind of glimpse into what could be?
Yeah, so I used to steal the quarters from my mother's pockets. That kind of quarter was a lot. So I would go down to the store and get these little candies. How do they call them? The anyways, I would just always like sneak in a quarter here and there, and on my way to school I'd stop and get a candy to kind of understand what it felt like to eat sugar, because we never had sugar in the house besides like holidays, like the baked stuff that she made or we made. So that was a little very rebellious of me. I don't think to this day she knows that I did it. Candies, they call the choo-choos.
Okay, yeah.
A little square candies, so much sugar. Oh my God, I killed my teeth. but it was like the rebel in me had to do it. And then there was another thing that I did when we got that CD player. It had the radio on it, even though my dad put crazy glue in it. At night when everyone was sleeping, I took out the crazy glue, because crazy glue just hardens and you just take it out. I would pull it out, pop the antenna, and try to find a radio station, even though I had no idea what radio meant. But all I knew, they spoke in English. And I'm like, I want to know what they're talking about. Honestly, I could not find any channels that was interest me or even any music. I think it was an AM versus FM and probably stuff. I don't, you know, English wasn't my first language. I don't even think I understood a thing they were saying then. But I kept on doing it because I just loved the thrill of doing something I wasn't allowed to do.
But depending on the channel, you could have got a very warped opinion of what the Western world is like. They're all obsessed with the news. They're all obsessed with gardening.
I always look back and I'm like, how come I couldn't figure out just Z100, like just the music channel or, you know, anything interesting. One other thing that I found that I did quite often, there was a phone number that you could call and they would give you information of what movies are playing in theater. It's also like a news phone line and it was free. I could just pick up the phone when nobody was home and call 1-800-TELL-ME. It was TL, tell me the numbers. I can't remember what. I would call it all the time. I had no idea what they were saying, but I loved it. It was great. Rebel and me just trying to figure out what they were saying. And kept on doing it till the end, until I understood what it meant.
And why do you think you were like that? And you seem to be quite unique in being like that from the community.
I always craved for more. I had no idea what I wanted, but I knew I craved more. And it took me many years to find out what I craved. I would say until I left, like in my low 20s, when I left the whole community is when I realized that's what I was looking for. I had that ah moment many times, but you know, it was just something that I was craving. It was love from my parents. It was a connection with something. I didn't know what it was. And I'm really thankful that I found it and I didn't stay stuck behind those barriers. And you know, because I could have easily just stayed there, but I didn't, because I wanted to know what it was that I was craving.
And can you trace it back to a specific moment? Like, looking back now, can you trace back to a specific moment where it all changed, where you were like, I'm going to leave, or this is not the future for me, or some kind of, or little chink in the armor, or something that just changed everything?
Yeah, I mean, obviously none of it came suddenly. You don't just wake up and say, okay, I'm going to leave. I can't do this. It happens in such slow pieces, slow progression. What I always connected with was very interesting. So obviously when I was a child at home, we were never, no movies, no TV, nothing, none of that sort. But when I got married, obviously arranged marriage, all that, my husband at the time, he was the cool boy in the community. Obviously, that's why they matched us up. he would watch movies. So he introduced me to movies. And I remember my first movie was The Pacifier from Vin Diesel.
That's your first movie?
Yeah. I've probably watched it since 1,000 times. I'm like, how did I like
that? And you still watch movies after that?
Wow.
Yeah. Let's not talk about that. But yeah, we would watch really bad movies, like the Jackie Chan movies, and like I just don't like them anymore. But anyways, back then that's what we watched. And I remember watching that the first time and I felt like Vin Diesel fell in love with their mom with the kids, right? And I'm like, that's an interesting feeling. I have never felt that way before, like having that feeling of wanting to kiss someone or feeling in love. And that really, for the next, you know, few years that I was in that marriage, watching those movies was very hard for me because I craved it. I craved that feeling of the love and connection. But I was like, I'm married. Shouldn't I have that too? But I never did. And I think that's what really pushed me out of my comfort zone to, you know, get that. And even though I didn't know that you can never get it, I thought, oh, just in the movies, it's not real, even though it probably is not real. I mean, of course it's not, but you do get it. And, you know, I've had great relationships. But that really pushed me out. That first movie that I watched, it really stuck with me for a long time until I realized, you know, I want more. I want to feel alive. I want to feel loved. I want to feel a connection with, you know, a spouse, a friend, a partner, you know, anyone. I just never felt that with anyone.
And do you think you were unusual within the community of not finding love within your marriage? Or do you think that that's not necessarily something that people are actually wanting from marriage?
Yes, their goal is not love. Their goal is raising a Jewish family with plenty of kids. But it happens. Some people do fall in love. I've known plenty of people that I do have great partners and great spouses. They have stuff in common. My partner, you know, we had nothing in common, absolutely nothing in common besides having, you know, we had a child together. But we were two separate people, just to have, you know, no day-to-day interaction that we felt connected to. And there was no love. There wasn't that feeling of like, oh my, I just really like him. There was nothing like that. So, and watching the movies really just made me go after it. After obviously we were divorced, but
and looking back now on what your interpretation of what was happening in those films and even the feelings and the values, do you think you were fairly? Do you think you were making the right conclusions about what the outside world was like?
Yeah, I think so. Because, you know, obviously I'm married, madly in love. Definitely. And I part of me just want to hug myself back then and say, you know what? you shouldn't feel this lonely. You shouldn't feel like this is normal, because that's not normal. And to have somebody make you feel like, no, this is normal when it's not, you shouldn't accept that. So I wish I can talk to these girls back then in my community. Mm. So, you know, if you don't feel that connection, there could be someone out there that you do have that connection with, even within the community, but you shouldn't just accept it.
And would there have been opportunities for you to have more of a say in who you're married to, or is it just a flat rule, parents decide?
Yeah, so yes, they asked me, do you want to get engaged to him? And I said, yes, they asked me. But again, it's all about the knowledge that I had before. You know, I saw mm-hmm. my sisters and my cousins all, you know, just getting engaged with the people that their parents picked for them. So it really mm-hmm. wasn't a choice. And also for me, I was at that point, you know, living in my parents' home where I felt I really need to get out. Just to take the next step. It was a very miserable home. There was no love. There was no, you know, joy. There was no excitement. And I had gotten expelled from school and they found out. It was a lot during that time. And I really felt like I need to get out. So the first
what were
person.
What you expelled for?
I was 16 at the time. So still had a year to go in school when they found out that I was friends with this other girl. She was a rebel, and she was, you know, I wouldn't say she had a boyfriend, but she was talking to boys, and that's a real big no-go in the community. Like, even your cousins, you can't even talk to your cousins. You can't talk to anyone, you know, in public especially. Like, you can't have interaction with boys. So they saw her having, you know, interaction with boys, and we were good friends. So they thought I have a boyfriend too. So they're like, you can't corrupt the rest of the kids. We got to kick you out. So they kicked me out. But I was at a point where I didn't care, because I really felt like I don't belong there. I had, you know, all these thoughts in my head of like, I want to get out there. I want to know what's going on. I want to talk to a boy. I want to really just get out of this place. I don't feel like I belong here. So I had no problem that they kicked me out. So I, you know, immediately got a job, and, you know, a year later I was like, I need to get out.
And you mentioned how you started to change and have these feelings watching the films. Do you think anyone else picked up on that?
So I was already married, so I obviously wasn't under my parents' roof anymore. If my ex-husband knew about it, I don't think so, because we were so not in touch with one another's feelings. And, you know, he did his things, I did my things. It was really not like a connection where, you know, you could see these things. It was more feelings inside that I felt, and I didn't share with anyone. So I don't think anyone really saw that coming.
And how do you then go from having, I guess, these dreams of a world that doesn't exist to actually thinking of leaving your community?
Like I said, it didn't happen overnight. It happened so slowly. So he introduced me to movies. Then we started going to movie theaters. So we would drive out of town, because there was no movie theaters in Williamsburg per se. So we would drive to Queens or City. So we would start to, like, you know, get out of our little box a little bit more. You know, we would start eating out at restaurants, kosher restaurants, of course, but, like, you know, the kosher Dunkin' Donuts in town was the hangout, you know. So we would go there every time, you know, once a week, and, you know, we buy these little munchkins, and I felt so great that I'm eating, like, bad food, because I've never did these things. So we slowly, you know, he slowly introduced me to a lot of things, but he stopped exploring versus I continued exploring. He stopped at the movie theaters and the Dunkin' Donuts and his cologne and his cufflinks, and I continued. I'm like, okay, I can wear my hair down. You know, it was a wig at the time. It was, like, you know, tucked in a kerchief and whatever. So I'm like, oh, I'm gonna wear it down because I think I'm gonna look better. And then it went, you know, to my skirts got shorter and my sleeves got shorter and my neck got more open. And, you know, then I started driving. I took driving lessons myself. So I started driving the car. So I had more freedom to go and come where I wanted. And then I'm like, okay, I can wear leggings at home. I don't have to wear the skirt and the stockings. I can just wear, you know, leggings at home because nobody sees me. So it happened really slowly. And my, you know, my husband at the time stopped. He's like, no, this is not what I do. Like, I'm done. I'm good with just watching the movies in theater and eating Dunkin' Donuts. And, you know, I don't want my mother to know what we're doing. Nobody has to know. We have to hide it. And I'm like, okay, sure, we'll hide it. But then obviously I got pregnant and had my son. So when he was born, I was 19. And that's when it really started shaking me up. I had to make decisions, not just for myself, but for him. We started talking about, oh, what school is he going to go to? Is he going to have the side curls? Are we going to shave his hair and put a, you know, the keep on his head? So all these questions started happening as soon as he was born. And that's when I realized that this is not going to work for me. I'm not going to be the one hiding my TV, you know, under the closet or under a blanket. We can watch TV, but my son can't. I can wear jeans under my skirt and my son can't, you know, wear whatever he wants to do. Mm. So that's when we started really going in separate ways. And, you know, within a little while, we got separated because, you know, I started, you know, going off on my own adventures and he didn't want to do that because he liked being in the community. The community has great perks. And for him, it worked. So he was just, I'm not doing this. So we went our own ways.
What does that actually mean, though? Do you have somewhere to go? And what happens with your son?
So then it was, you know, it was really hard time. It was 2 years that it was extremely hard for me. He kept on threatening me to take my son away from me. And even my own mother, who I still talk with at that time, threatened to take him away. Because, you know, they kind of heard from other people that, oh, she's going here, she's going there, she's hanging out with other people and stuff. So they would kind of know a little bit of what I was doing. Mm. And I started expanding my network, mostly through the internet. I found a friend who was also a divorced mom. So we got our own little apartment together. That's when I moved out. And then I joined a club, not a club, a group called Footsteps. I'm not sure if you heard of them. They're really great people. They are a support team for ex-Hasidic people, anyone wanting or trying or having left the community. They have a little center where you can come over certain hours. They have a support team, therapists, you know, school, you know, scholarship so that you can get back to school, like a whole team to help you navigate the tough time. So I joined them. I wasn't like very active in that community, but I did make a lot of friends and, you know, I slowly started building my own life. But the first 2 years was really hard. My ex-husband, like I said, my mom would threaten me to kind of take away my son. And I'm like, okay, take him. Now what? They never actually wanted that, or, you know, they were just threatening me to kind of say, hey, come back. You need to come back because we're going to take him away. I'm like, okay.
Was that driven through their, like, wanting the best for you, do you think? Or do you think it was driven more by their, how it affected them in the community?
Definitely the second option. They had to watch their younger kids of, you know, getting good matches, because if there's, you know, a bad black sheep in the family, it'll, you know, the other kids will be affected by that and they won't be able to get a good match and get married off properly. It's about their name and it's about the community as a whole. Like, they don't want anyone to leave and they will do everything they can to stop that. But as soon as they realize that it's over, then they're done. They throw you to the curb. You can never come back and that's over. So I went through all that with them. And, you know, obviously I haven't talked with them in a really long time. And, you know, sometimes it comes up during family, you know, holiday times and all that. Especially doing this article in Runner's World, it really triggered a lot of memories with my family. And, you know, but it always made me a better person and stronger. It makes me grow. And I have a long way to go. I feel like life is a constant learning, you know, experience.
And were you expecting that reaction from them? And are there certain brothers, sisters family members who you feel that actually you probably could have a connection with if it wasn't for the rest of the community almost coming down so strongly on them?
Not really, because they're so in their own little bubble, in their own life. Like, my oldest sister has about 12 kids, and she's maybe 40. Mm. She's a young, you know, a young person with so many kids. She's running around, you know, like, oh, I can't even relate to that kind of lifestyle. Like, they can't relate to my lifestyle. You know, when we talk back then, when I tried, it's like they don't even understand what it is like to, like, have anything outside of kids or raising kids or cooking dinner or washing laundry. So it's really like there's no connection, there's no relationship, and besides, they won't ever talk to me.
And, so, when you were talking about, I was going to ask you that question, like, where that process of knowing when they're going to cut you off, you know, they, if they can't get you back in, they're going to cut you off. What is that actually like when that happens? Does that mean all of a sudden that's it, all the contact ends, like no one will speak to you or something? How does that actually look at the point, you know, now I've been cut off?
It happens very slowly. It happened, okay. At least for me, it happened really slowly, because I didn't just come out one day and say, hey, I'm not religious, or hey, I'm wearing jeans. It happened really slowly. And in the very beginning, I still tried to respect them and respect their lifestyle. I'm like, okay, you know what? It didn't work for me, but maybe it works for them. And I would be respectful. So when I would go up to visit them, I would put on a skirt on top of my jeans. I, you know, cover my sleeves and all that. I would try to be respectful. After a while, I stopped doing that. I've learned that there's a lot of stuff that a little hard to talk about. I have one sister who actually left partially. I mean, she kind of left right now, but she had at that point had partially left the community, and she was still like one foot in and one foot out. And she reached out to me, and she was not in a good place at the time. So that was one trigger where I felt like, oh, it actually doesn't work for anybody. Because I, like I said, I was being respectful that maybe it works for some people, and I went my own way and it didn't work for me. So I found out that for my sister and all the trauma that she's going through because of our childhood, and the same as with my other brother, which he's unfortunately still stuck there on medication and all that because he was abused, and I really can't get into that. But so at one point I've learned that it doesn't work for anybody, no matter what.
And through the like footsteps, is that pretty much what everyone else has found, as though that there is no sort of halfway? That it
absolutely not. No, it's everyone's very different. Everyone's okay. Story is different. Everyone's family is different. Some people have great relationship with their family, even though they lead the most non-religious life, because their parents decided to accept them and they have unconditional love. My parents have conditional love. They will only love me. They don't even know what love means. They actually never uttered these words, but they will only care for me if I am religious. If I'm not, they see me as a failure. They see me as broken. They see me as somebody that needs to be rescued. So they don't know me. They don't feel me. They don't understand me. They have, there's absolutely nothing there with, even if they were to want a relationship, it wouldn't be, because they don't even know what it is like. So, and they wouldn't try. Only my mother. But it's not a black and white. It's very gray. Like I said, some people have, I have friends that have great relationship with their moms, and their moms are very respectful, and, you know, their siblings and so on. I did not find that to be the case in my story.
And what do you think you come across as a very caring person and a very good person. What do you think your parents tell themselves as to explain what's happened?
Like within their family? Like, what?
Yeah. Because this
I'm a failure. I'm broken. I'm corrupt. I'm gone. I mean, I'm the failure child, who they don't talk about.
And do you think people leaving ever triggers any reflection from individuals within the acidic community, or is it just easier to blame the person leaving?
Oh yeah, I mean, it's something that is also a big taboo in the community. You don't want to talk about the people who leave, because then you expose your kids and, you know, the other people to know their story and maybe give them ideas. So it's something you don't even talk about. I remember, you know, when I was a young child living there, I remember hearing stories, like, you know, super secretly and quietly, of people leaving and how they all say, oh, person is like dead and they're horrible and they're miserable because they are, you know, I remember this one girl who married some non-Jew, and I remember they were talking about her in the worst way possible. And I'm like, that's actually interesting. I want to hear more. But they obviously didn't want to say more because they're like, oh, she's interested. That's not good. So it's something we want to talk about.
And so when you then kind of stepped out of that community, what small changes really kind of helped you get through those first 2 years? And how did your expectations of the world, I guess, differ from the reality?
Oh, the world was horrible. The first 2 years was absolutely horrible. I actually got sucked into really bad people in the very beginning, because the bad people get to you first.
Yeah.
The good people aren't necessarily reaching out. It's the bad people who need more in their crew. So I was actually introduced to drugs during that time. It was not a good time for me. My son, you know, was really young at the time. I was having struggles, you know, financially. I had to find my place, and, you know, I still commuted for work back in, you know, in South Williamsburg. I still had a job there. So I would just be overwhelmed and, like, you know, having no one almost. I was immediately sucked into the drug scene, and I can say it took me maybe 4 to 6 months to realize that, hold up, that's not what I want. That's not who I am. That's not why I left. And, you know, this is what my parents would talk about people leaving them. Is this what you want to be? So it took me a really bad story to kind of, you know, wake up. I was at a weekend party when my son was at his dad, and I was roofied, and I woke up not knowing where I was or how I'm going to get out of there. And that the next day I was like, okay, this is not me. That's not what I want. So I actually quit drinking and smoking and all that stuff for, I would say, a good 2 years, until I cleaned my act together and just decided to pick up the pieces and figure out who I want to be. And that's really when I found fitness, after that time, because, you know, in the beginning I had all these friends and we would go partying, and all of a sudden I don't have these friends because I don't want to go with them anymore. So I had to really start over. And like I said, my son would go to his dad every other or every third weekend, and I had that 24 hour free, and I was like, okay, what am I going to do now? Back then I would, you know, we would go partying, and now I didn't want to go. So what was I going to do? I got membership at the YMCA down the street, and I was probably in the gym. So my son would leave Friday night before sundown. So I right away went to the gym. I finished work, you know, put on some, you know, sports clothes or whatever cotton leggings I had at the time, with my old sneakers that I bought many years ago that I never use. And I would take the bus down to the gym at the YMCA, where these big guys would work out, and I would try to copy whatever they were doing. And I loved it. I would be there for like 3 hours on Friday night. And guess what I did Saturday morning? The same thing. So I would like live in the gym for those few, you know, for those 24 hours. So I started, you know, becoming friends with the yoga instructors and the bodybuilders and people on the treadmill and all that. So I slowly, you know, started making more connections that were better for me outside of the community.
What were you getting from that? Because I understand once you started to make friends, that's obviously, that's something you are after. But before then, what was exercise giving to you that you were craving?
It gave me a thing to do when my son was gone. I was really sad because he would only be gone for like such a little bit, you know, the 24 hours in 2 weeks, that, you know, I had no coping skills of how to like do anything else. Like I didn't even, you know, I would never even cook for myself dinner when he was gone, because I'm like, I don't exist. It's only my son. I would literally do everything for him at the time. So I had nothing to do besides that. So I kind of used that as my getaway from reality, because it was dark. It was a very dark time where every time he would leave for his dad, I would just cry because I missed him and he was so young. And, you know, I lived for him, especially in the beginning. It was all I had. I didn't have anything else. And, you know, the day-to-day life with him was all I had. So when he was gone, there was a gap. There was a hole. Mm. So I filled it with gym workouts. And that's when I started meeting people. I started figuring out that actual fitness friends are fantastic and very motivating and inspiring. And there's more in this world. So that was really nice.
How did that feel like, obviously exploring the sort of the limits of your physicality for the first time? Because, you know, like when you're younger, normally at school, you will be doing, you know, a lot of physical exercise, you'll be doing like track stuff and all these different things. And then when you get a little bit older, you try and rediscover that. But this is you doing this for the very first time. This, I mean, that must have felt incredibly surprising to know that
your body must have been screaming.
Yeah.
You know, I'm actually very blessed. I have a physically very strong body, and I right away saw results. I was this weak little girl, never exercised before. I weighed almost nothing. I mean, I was never like, you know, dieting or anything, but I never understood fitness. So all of a sudden I start going to the gym and I'm starting seeing some little biceps and, you know, I got a little six pack and I'm like, ooh, I like it. The craving for more kind of started coming.
One thing I wanted to ask about is, it's about body image, because we've been brought up with all these media and adverts of, you know, what is supposedly the desirable body form for men and for women. But you've obviously not been exposed to that. So you mentioned, you know, getting biceps and having a six pack. Like, is there something you're aiming for, or something you're wanting to get? Or are you just thinking, cool, man, I've got muscles?
It wasn't so much about the looks for me. It was the feeling that I'm strong and I don't need anyone to help me or guide me. I can take care of myself. I can, you know, unpack my boxes and move on my own. It was more the mental strength that I appreciated. Mm. And yes, when you see the physical, it makes you the physical, you know, changes of your body. It helps too. But it was really feeling the independence that I can be okay. I can be strong on my own. I don't need my parents or the community backing me to help me be me. I can just be me because I am just me and I am strong enough for myself. So that's really what I appreciate about the gym and just in general fitness, that you can just do anything you want as long as you just decide to go for it. And that's really when my brain started opening up to other things, other friendships, other going outside the box. I started traveling with my son. I used to take him, you know, to places. We used to, you know, do really crazy road trips. You'd take him to the museums and all that stuff. And that's something I've never done before because I didn't know how to. I didn't know that those things exist. But once I was feeling confident with myself and who I'm becoming, it pushed me outside of the box with everything else.
And before we kind of step into that, I wanted to just pick you up on something you were saying before about how the first 6 months, really, you found yourself with the wrong people and basically doing quite extreme things. Do you think that that's the natural reaction for when you leave a community like the Hasidic community, to then just almost dive in to all of the the naughty things you're not meant to do?
Yeah, definitely. I think, I mean, everyone has their own, you know, things that they get into. But those kind of people get to you the first. And because I was so vulnerable and open to making new connections, that those were the people that came first. And I can honestly say those, all these other people also, they, most of them cleaned up their act too. They were all in the same situation as I was. It is really hard to cope coming from such a close-knit community, and all of a sudden you're forced into this big crazy world and you have to deal with everything else, and you don't know how to deal with it. You don't know how to, you know, take care of anything. You don't know how to pay a bill. You don't know how to, you know, find an apartment on your own, and all these things, all of a sudden you have to do on your own. And it's just easier to numb the pain, you know, have a drink or, you know, smoke up some pot, you know, all day long, you know, instead of actually dealing with, you know, what you need to deal, getting over the, you know, the issues with the family and all that. And, you know, I had to go through, and I'm still, I have, you know, I went through so much therapy sessions to really help me understand and kind of put things in the past, close the book, close the pages, and start opening new pages and, you know, exploring and figuring out what I wanted.
And do you think you were able to, I guess, make good assessments of people because you've had such a, almost a narrow interaction with the type of person you've met, that was it very hard to be able to understand who you can trust and to evaluate who is a good person and who isn't?
Yeah, it was very hard. It took a long time for that. And a lot of the, I was definitely taken advantage of many times by, you know, bosses and coworkers and friends and roommates and all that, because people sense vulnerability very quickly, and they just use it. You know, they don't really have bad intentions, but they kind of are like selfishly using that for their advantage. And it took a long time to really learn that, you know, because we are not brought up with any social skills or any life skills of how to like figure it out. And all of a sudden I'm 20 some having to do it for the first time. So it was very hard. I went through many heartbreaks with, you know, friends, family, roommates, bosses, coworkers, and all that until I really kind of figured it out.
And so when you then found this new sense of belief in being able to really take on anything, where did that take you, and when did you discover running?
So I started going to the gym, and then that was only when my son was at his dad. And then I realized that I really liked it, and it gives me a sense of belonging. So I, you know, had hired a nanny to come, you know, after he would be asleep, you know, after 8 p.m. And I would go to the gym and spend an hour and a half at the gym, come back, you know, start the day again. So it really helped me have a schedule, a day where it didn't allow for the bad things to kind of come crawl in there. So, you know, you kind of, I'm starting to figure out who I was and what I want to do and, you know, the plans and the goals, and, you know, started getting stronger on my own, got a better job. And then that kind of just took me to places.
And so good.
So it started with a gym, just kind of having a routine in the gym. After a while I was talking to this friend. I can't remember how it came up. I guess because I was in the gym, you know, 3 to 4 times a week, and this friend was telling me, "Hey, do you know what Spartan races are?" I'm like, "No, what is that?" And he was like, "Oh, I think you would really like it. You're so strong." I'm like, "Okay, Spartan.com." I signed up immediately. So I did, I think, 2 Spartan races. I'm not sure if you are familiar with what they are.
Very familiar with Spartan races.
They're really fun. But I wasn't really doing it competitively. I was just like, oh, I can climb up a mountain with a bucket on my head. This is really cool. The laughter were even greater, and I post them on social media, and everyone loved it, you know. So, and then I did. So I just like started like Googling like all kinds of weird races, because I didn't know what running was, and I didn't really do the Spartan, the running version. I probably walked it. I just did the, you know, pulling and the climbing and all that stuff. And then at one point I found the Empire State Building run up. it's a stair climbing race. And I'm like, oh, that sounds cool. I want to do that because I've been for cardio at the gym. I would do the stair climbing machine. And I'm like, okay, if I can do that, I'm sure I can climb the Empire State Building. No, sorry, hold on, backtrack. I would stair climb at the gym, and I remember I started working on my bucket list. I've never done a lot of things, so one of the things on my bucket list was climbing the Empire State. So I Googled it, climbing the Empire State, and then I found the race. So it was actually in reverse.
How many steps is it, or how many flights of stairs, or levels,
86 flights, and I think each flight has about 6 to 10. I can't remember. It's a long time ago. So you had to enter through a lottery, and you had to fundraise money. And I was determined, because remember, I've never done anything out of my comfort zone, and I'm like, do it. I'm crossing it off my bucket list. So I actually got in the race. It was in the winter. I think it was in February. And I trained. I actually trained for that race. I was doing the gym, the stair climbing in the gym. And then I think my friend told me I could come to his building and climb his the stairs, because it's like 20-some flight. And I did that a couple of times. And I felt ready. I get to the race day. And there's so many people. Like, it was packed, but you go off in seats because you can't fit, you know, 1,000 people in one race. It's not like a run. You know, you have to squeeze through the narrow building, and it sucked, but I was strong because I was partially trained, and I finished it in, I think, about 16 or 18 minutes, and I think it was pretty decent placing. I can't remember. I didn't even care about the placing. For me, it was just like, yes, I did it. I crossed it off my bucket list. And then I signed up for this other stair climbing race, but that was like a couple of months later. So I was like, okay, I have a few months. What now?
You found quite a particular niche, just stair climbing events.
It was actually fun. I know plenty of people who actually train for that, because you can win top dollar if you actually win it. Doing all these fundraisers, and it's very cool. So I remember I posted the picture of me finishing the race, and it was hosted by New York Roadrunners at the time, which we've talked about New York Roadrunners. So they're the, you know, large running company in New York. So this other friend saw that I was doing, you know, a New York Roadrunners race, and he says, hey, why don't you do this 5K with me one weekend? I'm like, what's a 5K? So he told me, just don't worry. Like, it's a run. It's, you know, around Prospect Park. I'm like, okay, sure. Like, I'm not taking, you know, I'm doing everything right now. I'm on a streak to, like, saying, you know, I'm not saying no to stuff like that. So how do I train? He said, oh, just run on the treadmill. It'll be fine. And it was in the winter. It was also in February. It was, the Empire State was probably in January, and this was in February. It was very close. It was like 2 weeks later or something. So I run on the treadmill. He says, oh, just doing a little bit of an incline just in case. I'm like, oh, this sucks. So it did like 1 minute intervals of running and then like walking for maybe like 10 minutes. I had no idea what running was like or how you're supposed to do it or where your arms go. I just like set the treadmill to like maybe five miles per hour. And I just kind of chugged along until I got stitches in my stomach. It felt awful. So I did that like twice. And then come Saturday, we drive to the race, and he signed me up, and which I actually noticed yesterday. I was signed up as a male. I have no idea why. I couldn't age in any age groups because I was a male. So we get to the starting line. I'm wearing like my cotton yoga pants that I bought, you know, like off the dollar store, I'm sure, down the street. Because I, you know, I'd go to the gym, but I never really like understood fitness. I would just, you know, work out. I was wearing a hoodie, a cotton t-shirt, you know, one of my work shirts, because I never really had like tank tops or anything. I would just work out with the shirt that I was wearing that day. I did have a pair of sneakers that I bought many years ago. Big bulky shoes, like grandma shoes. It was awful. And I had no hat, no gloves, because I was never really an outdoor person. I never walked or anything in the winter. Winter's, but you're supposed to be inside watching a movie. I don't know. You don't go outside. So he gives me his gloves, and I think I found a hat or something. And thank God, because it was so cold that day, February. And we get in the starting line. I'm like, well, where am I going? How am I going to know where to go? Oh, just follow everyone. You'll be fine. I'm like, okay, just run. Okay. I'm not sure if you ever run in Prospect Park, but there's a really big hill that it's about a quarter mile uphill, but then it's mostly flat because Brooklyn's not very hilly. So I ran and I get like to the bottom of the hill and I'm like, wait, this sucks. No, I can't do this. And I stop and I just did not want to go anymore because I've never run before. But I walk up the hill, and then after the uphill comes a really nice downhill. So I actually was able to kind of slowly pick it back up and run. And I finished and I felt amazing. I felt like $1 million, like I've just finished something that was so hard. I've never trained before. It like there was no oxygen in me. I felt my legs were going to literally they were hurting so bad, but I loved it. And the next day I signed up for a 4 miler, or I think it was 2 weeks later. And then I signed up for a 10K, and then I signed up for a 15K, and then I signed up for a half marathon, and then the rest is history. So it started quite interesting. Yeah.
And what is it that you'd say you get from running that you don't get from something like the gym?
So I am naturally not a runner. I don't have the strong lungs or you know, the stamina to hold me for too long. I do have, I'm good at the gym. So I have, you know, the fast muscle twitches that, you know, I can get really good at exploding fast off the track or finishing fast on, you know, on a workout. I don't have the stamina. I never had it naturally. So for me, having to build that is something that is a challenge. And I love a challenge. I think if things come easy, then the reward is just not there. You take it for granted. You know, I walk into the gym and it's a piece of cake for me. I know what I do. I feel good. I love it. I have I write up my own programs. I know what I'm going to do. But with running, it is such a challenge. And that's what I love about it, because it's a challenge. I have to push myself. You know, they always say, if it were to be easy, anyone can do it. And then there's no reward. So for me, it's the gratification of working hard towards a goal, working really, you know, to achieve something, setting your eye on something and getting it done. And it's the same with my life story, because I didn't have any of this done for me. I had to literally decide where I want to go. I had to decide, okay, I can continue drinking and smoking and taking drugs, or I can really figure out what I want to do, write it down, have a schedule, make up my mind and go for it. And that really, with fitness combined, it really showed me that I can just do it. I just have to decide what I want to do.
And do you think if you'd have run when you were younger, do you think it would have changed your outlook, or would have almost given you a bit of happiness and maybe made you more content?
I can't imagine running as a child. It's too far-fetched from my mind. I don't understand what that would feel like. So it's too far away. And I think I would probably also take it for granted, because it's something that you do. You know, I tried forcing my son now to run and he just doesn't want to. I'm like, all right, you know, well, kids, but yeah, like it's a privilege to run. It's a privilege for me to just every step that I can take. I feel lucky and blessed that I have my health and my mental strength to do that, because I didn't always have that.
And did you ever run back through your former community?
Absolutely. I lived in North Williamsburg for a long time, which is literally just over the border of South Williamsburg. I lived there with my husband for a couple of years, because it was closer to my job. I worked in the city and I used to do the commute. It was really far from all the way in like other side of Brooklyn. So we moved, when we moved in together, we moved into North Williamsburg. And also I met the amazing team, the North Brooklyn running team over there. So, and I worked there. So it was just all like, I had to live there. It was just perfect opportunity to live closer to a training team and closer to work. And, you know, with my partner, because he lived there too. So we moved in together there. Would we directly run through Williamsburg? No. But the one route that we would always take is Kent Avenue. There's plenty of Jewish people walking there in synagogue and, you know, that Saturday morning or whatever. So yeah, I would always see that.
And if you were to say, if you were to run past former friends, former family members, what do you think they'd make of you now if you were running free, smiling and just blazing through?
They wouldn't recognize me.
Really? They wouldn't actually know?
No.
Wow.
No, they would absolutely not recognize me. It's too far away from their brain to even see the resemblance between this Jewish woman in the community who once had, you know, braided hair and like cold clothes and now wearing sports bra and tank tops, you know, running through the street. They don't see it. When they see a person like that running by, they see them as like, you know, an outsider. So they don't actually look closely. But I did do a little photo shoot. My husband's a photographer. Photo shoots. And one of the photo shoots that was in front of my parents' house. And this one great photo of me just standing there, not even in running clothes, just regular clothes. And this Hasidic person like blurred out in the background. It's a great photo. And I was kind of hoping that my parents would come down and see me, even though they wouldn't actually see me, but I would see them. But they didn't come down.
Were you tempted to knock?
I'm sorry?
Were you tempted to knock on the door?
No, that would be too hard. Because, no, I don't know. I've never been tempted to knock. I don't think I would be greeted nicely. I think I'd be kicked out immediately. So why dig your own grave? Why do something that will, you know, hurt you later? So, no.
I know one of the reasons why you wanted to tell your story on the podcast was partly to help anyone else who's out there. What would your message be if someone does manage to hear this, who's part of that community and is struggling currently?
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, if you have a dream of more, if you're craving something else, go out there and explore it, because there's something out there. There's no end to your dreams. And if you feel like there's more, go get it.
And I, as you said, the first 2 years after leaving were your darkest times, you know, really, really tough. What advice would you give to people if they are stepping into that? And also, what do you think we can try and do to help people who are struggling?
Having a support system is the most important thing, and the right support system. So, you know, allowing yourself to open up to people who, you know, could potentially help you is important, even though it is hard to open up. It's really hard to, you know, revisit certain memories and certain stories that you don't really want to, you know, constantly think about. But it's important for people to understand your current life, your current struggles, and that's how they can relate to you, help, you know, try to, you know, connect in a certain way. And, you know, I've had back, you know, many years ago, not now anymore because I'm too old now, but back then I've had a lot of people reach out to me from the community. And it was really nice to be able to give them that listening ear, where, you know, I say, it's going to be okay. Maybe not now, but maybe in a year, 6 months, or whatever, how much time it needs. But go through the motions, because you need to go through that in order to become you. We've never, you know, had the opportunity to feel or be or even experience. So all of these steps, just think of it as a process. You're going to get there, you're going to get through it, and then you're going to look back and say, wow, I came a long way and I did it on my own with or without the help from others. And that's something you're going to carry for the rest of your life. Your kids, your friends, your family, the people who care about you will know that about you. And that's unique, and that'll be you. So the struggle's worth it.
And do you, would you recommend for people to try and steer clear of alcohol, of drugs, of smoking when they first leave? Or do you think that is part of the transition period almost?
No, I would not recommend it to anyone because you can easily get sucked into a really bad world. And unfortunately, that world is out there for anyone, Hasidic, ex-Hasidic or not. For anyone vulnerable to go through that is the worst addiction to get into. You know, I got addicted to fitness. Is it a good addiction? Yes or no? You can argue either way. My non-running friends would say I'm crazy and it's unhealthy and I'm running away from reality. Okay, sure. Maybe try running yourself and, you know, you'd see the love, the passion I have for the sport. But, you know, I always tell people, anyone struggling, regardless where they come from, go for a walk. Get out there. Open your eyes. Take your camera. Go explore something you've never explored. And, you know, don't get sucked into the darkness. Don't stay inside. I don't know if it works for everyone, but it's worked for me and it's worked wonderful for me.
And something I've never really been clear of my whole life in terms of my philosophy, but also in terms of what is right and what is wrong, is when you now look at something like the Hasidic community, do you think we should try and reach out to people and try and let them know that there is a, you know, you can have love, you can have other things, or do you think we have no place in doing that and actually most of the community are perfectly happy being left alone and we shouldn't get involved in any way?
So that's a great question and great topic and probably a longer conversation. It's hard to intervene because while you're in it, you don't feel like there's anything wrong. It's only for those who feel that there's something missing you can connect with because they give you a little in. But the rest of them, they feel like this is their life and they love it and they're perfectly content. But I don't believe so because of my fair share experience with my family, my sister, my brother. And furthermore, the lack of education that they provide for children, kids, for everyone, doesn't allow for anyone to get outside and they kind of trap you in like that. So if anyone does decide to leave, they have no coping skills, they have no life skills, they have no social skills to get out there and make it. So I don't think that, you know, yes, we should intervene, but in other ways, like I have one of my friends who also loves the community. He owns an organization that helps, that is trying to help the education system in the Jewish community to help them have a better education. So if they were to leave, they have better opportunities of anything, you know, getting a job, getting, you know, going to college, et cetera. So in intervening, it's like they have, you know, the freedom of, you know, religion to do whatever they want. But if, you know, you can sense when somebody comes forward or even, you know, when you go running, you see this little kid looking at you, you know, maybe it's not the end of the world to stop and say, hello, how you doing? And like, if they reach out and if they want to connect with you, they will. It's probably hard for them because they don't know how to do it. But I do believe that they have the rights to do what they want. We can do what we want, but, you know, within limits.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and, you know, being so honest and open with us about what's been just an incredible journey. I mean, are there any last messages you'd like to send to people out there, whether they're runners, whether they're, you know, questioning their current faith, whether they're, you know, going on a journey themselves?
I think we covered it all. And I just hope that, you know, people get out of their comfort zone a little bit, like I did coming on this podcast today. And just even starting to run for my first time back in 2013 when I, you know, never understood that. So I think people need to push themselves because you can do it. You just got to take that one step out, one foot.
And we always ask our guests, like, if people want to follow you. And I know you're quite a private person, so it might be that you don't necessarily want people to follow you, but if people are wanting to connect with you or to ask you questions or things, is there a way that you'd be happy for them to do that?
They can definitely pick up the next Runner's World magazine. That'll be published next week. There's a great story that my friend David Alm wrote and some great photos that my other friend Drew took. That's definitely a way to, you know, give back to the running community because I feel like Runner's World did really a lot for me by taking on my story. And, you know, it's allowed me to, you know, have a voice. And, you know, I would personally, you know, never talk about, you know, my life in such a public setting, but I'm happy to talk more, hopefully, you know, soon. Maybe I will try to open myself a little more if people have questions or, you know, anything like that.
And if you've got any
time.
And last question. Well, firstly, is are you tempted to try and get to somewhere like Dubai to take on the tallest building, every step, every stair of that? And are there many other things left on your bucket list?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I'm always up for a challenge. I think that just doing anything right now is definitely, you know, exciting. And yeah.
Well, Connie, thank you so much for coming on. It's been amazing. And if you ever make it to London, or if you can, with anything we can help you with as a podcast, then please let us know.
Thank you so much. It was a really pleasure talking with you guys.
Worth the wait.
Oh, that was absolutely worth the wait. I've got to get this out of the way because I couldn't stop thinking about it, that, you know, out of everything she's been through and, you know, the gradual way in which she came out of that community and everything she's felt since, for The Pacifier to be the film that is basically your first introduction to life outside the Hasidic community. I mean, that is, I don't know if you could choose it could have been a lot worse, actually, but how you'd ever watch that film in the same way again, I don't know.
Yeah, and actually, if we had longer, it would have been great to go through a list of all the perceptions she had, the reality of it, you know, what she makes of all these weird things that we don't even realise are weird.
Because the thing is, what you would expect from like this Hollywood ending to what she did is that she comes out of a community and she's kind of walking around, you know, society, going, "Oh, look,
birds are singing. Ice cream's so tasty."
Yeah, exactly that. And it's just not the reality of it at all. That, you know, the whole process, because that's the thing, you think it's going to be like a really short, sharp, "Okay, I've made a decision to leave" type thing, but that's just not the reality of it, and like, how the length of time that took, and, you know, the fact that you're pulling away from a community that has been so, you know, the fact that she couldn't speak English for such a long time, she only spoke Yiddish, you know, and how you're so ingrained within the community, you don't even think about that. It's just hard to comprehend when we have such an open way of living, you know, and there is that sense of.
But it also seems like our culture is just permeates everywhere.
Yes, absolutely.
But that seems to be true of, if you ever hear interviews of people who've left North Korea, if you speak to people who've left the Yiddish community or similar, that seems to be the case, that it is incredibly hard to assimilate. And it's so unfortunate that, you know, that she was saying that you do meet the wrong ones first.
Yeah, you build up. No, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? It's always you build up a resilience to knowing, you know, that. I suppose that's the thing. As a parent, that's the thing, isn't it? You want to protect your children. It's the same. You want to protect your children from the bad things in the world. Yet, if you don't expose them to some of those bad things early on, they'll become susceptible when they do go out on their own. And it's kind of the same thing. It's, you know, you don't really create. I mean, they're purposefully not creating independence. They're purposefully creating a situation whereby outside is bad. Therefore, if you go outside, you're going to befall these bad things. And that must have been really, really tough, because almost the things that they tell you what happened came true.
Like, yeah.
When she left, then, you know, it must have been so tempting to think, "I'm going to run back to the community that I'm used to," because, you know, they were absolutely right about, yeah, the bad things that are out there for me. So I think it's really difficult, you know, with everything she said, just to understand the fortitude that you need to be able to, like, leave your parents and everything that you know.
And I just love the story that it was exercise. And I think this happens to a lot of us, right? Where it's having something that you're in control of, that you can improve in, and you can feel like you're starting to master it, that allows you to have the confidence and to also almost to find yourself. And that's what she went through. But actually, I think a lot of people in running do that, where it becomes an escape from everything around them, and it becomes your own little private universe that you can enjoy and take pleasure and pride in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's the thing. It's the thing that you have control over. The thing that that really surprised me, the fact that, and of course, this makes perfect sense when she's talking about it, but the fact that you've never really explored your physicality as a when you're younger, when you're at your most active and you're most fit and everything. And so this is, you know, in your 20s is the first time you're really seeing what your body can do and really know what the limitations of your body, because that must be hard. Because, you know, now at this age, you know, we kind of go, oh, when I was younger, I could do all of these things. You knew, maybe not didn't know the limits, but you knew what you could do. You knew that, you know, oh, I used to be able to run really fast and climb, and, you know, I could lift and all these different things. And now you're trying to get back to it, but not having any perception of what you could have done or could do, and discovering that for the first time must have been like overwhelming. And, you know, and things like endorphins and everything else that comes with that. I mean, I can understand like why someone would go from, you know, having a situation where you've been in a situation where you're taking lots of drugs, it's quite addictive personality, to go in somewhere like, you know, a lot of strength training, like real, like lifting weights and everything else like that. The two kind of go, and running does as well, actually. There's, you know, we've got a load of ex-caners in the Dubai community who, you know, used to be a certain way, and they replaced, you know, one pathological desire for something else.
But I've always struggled with, and we talked about it at the end, whether are we right to try and interfere, or are we not? And when it's right to have respect for people's decisions, or when it's your duty to influence. And I still don't really know with this one, where, I mean, it does sound like the females are brought up in very limited and quite unhappy situations. And there is, but should we help? Should we not? And that's what I still haven't figured out. And, you know, next time I run through Stamford Hill, will I be smiling, like saying shalom and stop and have a chat with a little kid? I stood at, because part of me thinks that could be planting the kernel that then grows into something, you know, that intrigue. Because it must come.
You running anywhere in a pair of shorts talking to children is a bad idea. I would stay well away from that as an idea.
But but it's interesting, isn't it, that I personally think if you have a belief that you're confident in, then you should welcome challenge. You should welcome.
Wait a minute, aren't you? You're going against most religions there, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, when I'm fascinated by cults, and that's the one thing they tend to do. They tend to isolate you and to push away support networks. And
which is why no one should ever go to the Parkrun discussion group. No one should ever go to, I used to be a runner, now I'm not, because those groups are all completely wrong in the things that they tell you. Stay in the bad boy running group, because this is the truth.
Absolutely. But thank you so much, Connie, for coming on. It was worth the wait. And if you've got any guests, do badders, that you'd like us to interview in the future, this interview was less about running. You know, running was only the last, well, really it was about exercise more than running. And running was the last 10%. But if there are stories that you think are a little bit left of field for what we normally do, let us, you know, send your suggestions in, because we're just fascinated by people more than anything else. So letters at badboyrunning.com. Also guests at badboyrunning.com. Any episodes you'd recommend, JD, based off this one?
No, but I would listen next week, because we have got, this doesn't sound as though it's going to be related in any way, but next week we've got the Russian dopers. And there's a lot of similarities between some of the things that are said in that and this. It doesn't make any sense at the moment, but listen to that, and you'll hopefully see the connection that I'm making to that.
But also, actually, the first interview we did with Ali Bailey, that was really interesting because he had worked in the music industry. And there was a lot of booze and that side of things. And she was struggling with her mental health and also her own identity. And she found that running became her salvation. But actually also then, in the same way that became almost a crux that wasn't necessarily good for her mental health in the way she'd initially expected. So, yeah, that's a really good one too. But that's interesting, guys. If you'd like to ask questions to our future guests, then follow us on Instagram. Please do review and rate us wherever you listen to this podcast. The reviews help us with credibility for getting future guests. Anything to add, Jody?
No, if you want to join the discussion, head over to the Facebook group and join Bad Boy Running Podcast. Ask three questions you get in. If you want to check out the Bad Boy Running Club, head to club.badboyrunning.com and all details are there.
And if you did like the sound of that vodka, you wanted to try it out and be the very first group of people to be able to feedback on it and help shape a future brand, it's Kaveri Drinks, K-A-V-E-R-I, drinks.com, and the code is FYB. That's just it, guys, and we'll see you next time.
See you later.
Bye. I must admit I was a clown to be messing around, but that doesn't mean that you have to leave town. Come back, yes, and give me one more try, 'cause a love like this should I never ever die. Come back.
Fuck you, buddy.